So welcome, those of you in class and those of you online. As you can see, we're up to class five in this module called Establishing a Daily Practice. So we begin as we normally do by taking refuge together, generating the mind of enlightenment, and saying those preliminary prayers. Then the class will begin. During the class, there's times for questioning and also time for meditation. So please get comfortable in your seat there. You want to have your back straight. If possible, your feet flat on the floor or on a cushion. So drop your shoulders and check how your head is sitting on your neck. So the chin is slightly tucked in. You can place your hands wherever you like, as long as they're comfortable. And you can either close the eyes completely or keep them slightly open. Then let the body breathe itself. You're sitting comfortably, you are relaxed, and your body is breathing itself. And while the body breathes itself, you're paying attention to how it feels. What's the body feel like when you breathe normally and naturally? And while you feel comfortable in your seat, imagine that in the space in front of you, appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light and he's sitting on a golden throne. And he is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, and other Buddhas, meditational deities, bodhisattvas, arahats, and protectors. And there are many enlightened beings in front of you. Then imagine that surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, family members, close friends, difficult people, and strangers. And all of us are facing the Buddha and his entourage. We recollect that all of us have an equal wish to avoid suffering, and we equally wish to be happy. All of us are equally lacking genuine happiness. So although we experience this at present, remember that the causes of suffering can actually be eliminated, and the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. A desire to actualize our genuine happiness by dispelling the causes of suffering. As we are all equal in our wishes, desire to dispel the sources of suffering, the causes of suffering, not just for yourself, but for everyone. And to do this, we're going to rely upon those who have already done this before us. These include the Buddha and the spiritual entourage in front of you. And they, of course, have developed all their good qualities by relying upon the teachings called Dharma, and themselves as a community. So please join me in reciting the refuge in Bodhicitta prayer three times. I go for refuge since I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being. And these lights and nectars pour over us and all the beings surrounding us. And these lights and nectars remove obstacles and empower our potentials of method and wisdom. We recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of compassion, love, joy, and equanimity. We decide to establish all beings in those states by reciting, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. They pour down over us, saturating our body and mind, to reveal these four boundless qualities effortlessly manifesting. And with faith and devotion, we recollect the field of merit and prepare ourselves to purify the mind, to accumulate and then increase merit. The Buddha and his companions reappear as a field of merit. And we say before them, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now we're going to offer a mandala with the understanding that this will provide resources for us throughout countless lives. It will counteract our greed and miserliness, along with clinging to our body and our ideas. To think now that your body sort of vanishes within the sphere of emptiness, then reappears as a dependent arising universe, which you will offer to the field of merit. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four countries, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. We've released the offering and the Buddha accepts it and he smiles at us. We look up, we meet the gaze of the Buddha and we feel accepted and at ease. And from the heart of the Buddha, an emanation leaves, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now the emanation starts to descend, coming down to the level of your heart. It begins to expand from your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And then within that enlightened state, you hear the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha resounding. And you join in, reciting it three times, saying, Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tayata Just reciting a few times under your breath. I think now you've accomplished the two purposes, purpose for yourself and the purpose of others. And recognize that this is an imaginary process, but it forms the causes for you to actually attain enlightenment and accomplish these two purposes. To allow some joy to arise, something meaningful has been done on this very, very special day, the Day of Miracles. And then breathing in through the nostrils, exhale through the mouth. And then set your eyes flush open, move your shoulders, lay your arms, feet, whatever feels right for you. So again, welcome. And we'll begin our class now. So we're going to look at, today, we're going to be looking at refuge and how to accumulate merit and the practices of, and purification. These are some of the books that I've used to prepare the class. The major books, of course, that we've been using are the very top left-hand corner and the big one on the right. And right next to the top left-hand corner, you can see Lama's Lopa, the picture of Lama's Lopa sitting in the cover, or the method to transform a suffering life into happiness. Thank you, Yvette. Yeah. Okay, so that's what we've done. Now, in the previous weeks, we've gone through this speech lesson. So today, we're not going to do the whole thing. This is quite a packed class, but I'll just run through it so you once again become familiar with it. So you know, we always begin with the emptiness meditation. Then we arise as the deity or the body of light. We imagine on our tongue the little syllable, which symbolizes emptiness, turns into a moon disc, which symbolizes the mind of enlightenment. In the center of the mind of enlightenment is the syllable om, which represents the body, everything physical. And surrounding it are these three mantra garlands, which represent speech and dependent arising. Light rays go out from these, they gather up all the strength and power of all the enlightened speech, they draw it back into you, and you recite these mantras and so forth. Purification takes place under each mantra. They absorb into the arm, and this is all withdrawn by there, and you come back out and begin your practice. Now, whenever we do this practice, of course, is to sort of perfect our speech. And Rinpoche says that whatever we recite is multiplied about 10 million times. So actually today would be a fantastic day to do all these practices. When we finish the practice, we dedicate it by saying this here. May my tongue send space, have all the courage of the ones gone to bliss. By the magnificence and power of my words, may all sentient beings be subdued, may all the meanings of whatever words I say be accomplished. Hopefully over time, if you try to do this practice, it doesn't take very long. It's just a little bit longer today, because like I said, a lot in our class. Okay, so let's have a look now at our beginning of our class, what we're covering. We're basically looking at these, we're continuing to look at these six preparatory practices. We introduced these last week. So last week we began by looking at the first practice, cleaning the room and arranging representations of body, speech, and mind. And the idea here is to actually purify the mind. Then the second preparatory practice was to obtain and arrange the offerings. And the idea here is to cultivate abundance, to get away from the sense of scarcity. I don't have enough all the time. Then our third preparation was to take the seat, take refuge, and generate the mind of enlightenment. And this is what we talked about like last week. So today we're going to, I think we've still got a little bit more to do on refuge. So we want to talk a little bit about that, but then also talk about this idea of working against this idea of what we call spiritual isolation. So that is combated by or worked against by having this idea of this field of merit, like all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas appearing. So we're not alone in our practices. In fact, we've never been alone, but we often feel that we are. We move on to that, and then we begin to look at what we call the field for accumulating merit, where we practice the seven loops. And that's what we'll still be when we talk about these two mainly today. And finally, we seek inspiration to ripen the mind stream. So we're going to finish start here, the ending bit of part three, aligning energy and motivation. We talk about like taking refuge and generating the mind of enlightenment. And we want to look at why we're doing that. Well, we do this because our present situation is one of vulnerability. So here it says, adrift in the bottomless ocean of cyclic existence, being devoured by the powerful monsters of attachment, hatred, and the other passions, to whom should I turn for refuge or protection? What can I do to protect myself from this? So the primary obstacle for us to enter the spiritual path is the illusion of security. We mistakenly believe that money, status, or friends can protect us from the fundamental sufferings of the existence we find ourselves in. However, as the Master Vijnana, who wrote this particular verse, points out, we are in a bottomless ocean where these worldly supports of status, money, and friends cannot save us from the sea monsters of our own uncontrolled desires and hostility. So the question arises, if these worldly methods of status, money, friends fail, what will produce a valid search and the discovery of true protection? So the according to the Lama Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the path, a legitimate request for protection or refuge relies on two specific causes, one of which is called the fearful cause. And this causes a sense of fear, or it's a generate a sense of fear. But this fear is not a panic-stricken, paralyzing terror. Rather, it's a rational, wise dread, and it's born from looking ahead. It's a realization that if one dies with a mind dominated by anger, greed, or confusion, the result will inevitably be a future of intense suffering in the lower states of existence. So we need this sense of fear. And as you can see here, Vignaga is using the imagery of the ocean. And he's asking us to sort of try to imagine yourself or some other person floating in the middle of a violent sea. And below them are the predators. These are reflections, of course. And they realize that this small raft they're on, which is their worldly resources, is falling apart, it's disintegrating. And at that precise moment of realizing their own helplessness, a massive, unsinkable ship appears. So the fear of drowning is what propels this person to start going for that ship. Right? Without the fear, they would remain on that disintegrating raft until it's too late. So fears are only negative when they are without direction. When fear is directed towards a valid object of protection, then it becomes a fuel for liberation. So what types of fear are we to generate? The first fear is what's going to take, is the fear of a future life where we find ourselves reborn into one of these states. We either find ourselves as an animal, a ghost, or some being in a hellish realm. Now, I watched a film the other day called The Octopus, My Teacher. Has anybody seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So you know, right? There was that creature. And what happened at the very end? You know, it was quite an amazing story, isn't it? And especially if you look at through the lens of Dharma too, you can find a lot of correspondences there. So we certainly don't want to be like that octopus, right? Or any of those other creatures down in that ocean. You all saw what happens down there, right? Every animal eats another animal. That's what they do. And you know, you saw how that octopus was, even though that guy had a great deal of affection for the octopus, that octopus was also out there killing, consuming other beings, wasn't it? And then he himself was consumed in the end. There's a lot of opinion there. In fact, the texts say the worst forms of suffering are in the ocean, the deepest oceans. That's where it takes place in this world of ours. So we certainly don't want to end up as a creature in the sea, or anything less than what we've got. So we need to be afraid of that possibility, because one thing is certain in this life, we will leave it. And many of us cannot be sure where we'll end up. So fear here is very useful. You go, I don't want to end up like that. But then you go, well, what do I do? What do I do to stop? Now, this, of course, these three types of realms are all within what we call samsara, the cycle of uncontrolled rebirth. And within the cycle, we as human beings are also experiencing different forms of suffering. And these sufferings are, of course, what they call the three sufferings of dukkha, which is obvious suffering, the suffering of change, whereby we often mistake pleasure for happiness, but in fact it can actually cause a great deal of distress. And then the pervasive suffering, which means just being a human being. The suffering is pervasive because we have no control over the body.
Just being alive.
Just being alive is a form of suffering in this sort of body and mind. Most of us will have some experience of that already. No? So these are sufferings we're going to face in the sun. And if we're not careful, the types of sufferings we create and engage with could throw us into these lower realms in the next life. And as human beings experiencing dukkha, change, and the phase of suffering, in particular, all living beings experience what they call the eight types of suffering or the six types of suffering. And some of these sufferings are in particular, we suffer when we do not get what we want, and we suffer when we are separated from what we have, And what's another good one for the
Uncertainty.
sufferings of uncertainty? The sufferings of, they go the high and low.
Loneliness.
Loneliness, yeah, this, as we all know, there are a lot of them. So all these types of sufferings are useful to us if we're not sort of averse to them. We should say, man, I need to protect myself. What can I do to escape this type of suffering? It's very valuable to acknowledge suffering, especially to get down to what they call pervasive suffering, the suffering of pervasive conditionality. I think for most of us, we're not really aware of that. But if you were saying it's just being a human being with a body and a mind of the human being, that's the source of suffering. It can also be a source for liberation if we know how to use it. But if we don't, like we are at the moment, it's suffering. So the idea here to use our fear as a useful means to find, to take refuge, is to actually be afraid of pain and the bad experiences of future lives. Like again, so remember that octopus, right? I mean, what happens over time, right? I think it gave birth to, I was saying, hundreds of thousands of little baby octopus children, right? How many survive? About 2 years. That came up on your hand, don't. Now, so that's one side of it. Now, the second cause for taking refuge is this ability to know, yeah, I can avoid all that. It doesn't have to happen to me. But there's something I can do about that. Which leads us into this verse here, the confident causes creating refuge. So the one in whom all faults are completely absent and in whom all good qualities are always present in every way. If you are sensible, you will go to such a one for refuge. It is right to praise him, honor him, and live according to his teachings. So what we're doing here is we're finding somebody who has escaped these types of future sufferings. In fact, they've escaped future sufferings, all sorts of sufferings. Right? And they're willing to say, look, I'm willing to share my knowledge with you. This is what I did. And you can do this too. Right? So if you, like I say, if you understand there's a way out, there's no need to despair, is there? Right? But knowing there's a way out doesn't mean to say we're going to be free, does it? And we actually have to do something more than just know about it. But here's someone who did more. We find the Buddha as a historical answer, our own teachers, as people who are presently doing it. And we can also rely on the texts and the knowledge contained within them to look at how phenomena appear to have an inherent existence, and it's already stable and permanent, like it seems like you can't get out, but in fact that's an illusion. Or it's an accident. It only looks like I can't get out. In fact, I can get out. This reminds me of the story of a fellow who was locked in a jail cell. And so he just kept, like, he thought he wanted to get out, of course, right? But the door was there, so he grabbed the door and he just kept pushing it out. And it wouldn't open, and so he thought he was stuck, but he just had to pull it in. But it was always open. But he only did, he didn't try both ways. He went one way. So we don't want that to happen to us, right? Our life does seem, we do seem to be locked in, but we're actually not. So when we go for refuge, the literal way we do this is we just recite that prayer. I go for refuge in the book, Guru, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or I go for refuge in the three verses, nine ones, whatever, we recite it. But we need to remember that to actually achieve that refuge, we need to be afraid, but we also need confidence, fear and faith, in other words. So how do we apply this? Well, suppose, for instance, that we are insulted. What we normally turn to, I would suggest, is anger. Right? That's, so somebody says harsh words to us, what do? We respond back like harshly to them. Now, this, of course, never works. Responding to hurt with hurt is burning down the whole world, right? So how should we respond? Well, with patience. So this is like we take refuge with patience, so we don't harm ourselves and we don't harm the other person. If we take refuge in our anger, like I say, we burn ourselves down, we hurt them too. There's no winners, there's no victors if we respond to harm with harm. I think anybody who's ever been in a relationship, you end up yelling at each other, you know, right? It's not pleasant, it doesn't work. Someone has to stop, right? And say, sorry. So here you don't even have to start. The other person get angry, but you just be calm. Of course, this is not easy, we know that, but it is the method, right? We need to train ourselves and so forth. So these are, in other words, turn to wisdom and patience when insulted, rather than turning to anger. And when we take refuge, it's really important to understand that refuge is the awakened, sorry, the result or the ultimate refuge is the awakened nature of your own mind. But we have to begin by trusting somebody else. We need an example. That's the living beings, what we call the Buddha or the teachers. You see, they have been able to do it, their mind is changed. We want to be the same. We know it's possible because they were just like that from the right from the get-go. They were just as troubled as we were, but they trained. They're willing to share their methodology with us, but we have to do it. That's the thing. Now, when we sort of taken refuge. And as you can see in our practice itself, we took refuge together, we generated the mind of enlightenment. Then what did we do this morning? What was the next step? What was the next prayer we did? Okay, I'll help you. It's called the Four Immeasurable Thoughts. Yeah. And in that, we said things like, what was it?
May all sentient beings have happiness.
When all sentient beings have happiness, the cause of happiness, they will be free from suffering and the cause of suffering, and so forth. They will be free from attachment and aversion. These four, they're called immeasurable thoughts because they're directed towards all beings. In other words, they say it's immeasurable, the amount of living beings. You can't count them. But we want our thought to embrace each of them. Each and every one of them. So the thought becomes immeasurable. It's sometimes called boundless. Boundless and I think limitless. So we have boundless love, limitless love, immeasurable love, boundless compassion, limitless compassion. And here, when I put, as you can see, I've just described what they are, the immeasurable. What its purpose is or function, and what's an antidote for? So you can see here that the immeasurable love is the wish for others to possess happiness and the causes of happiness. And it's an antidote to malice or ill will. And we come to limitless, immeasurable compassion. To wish for others to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And this is stop our own mind of cruelty or harmful intent. Now, I find something quite interesting here, and it's this wish. It is a wish, it's an aspiration. So, as you can see on each side, we have different antidotes. The third one, boundless and limitless immeasurable joy. Fantastic antidote to the mind of jealousy or envy. And lastly, boundless and limitless, immeasurable equanimity. To be all beings equal, free from extremes of attachment to friends or aversion to enemies. And this stops the minds of partiality and bias. So, what does partiality or bias mean here? Any ideas?
Yes.
Yeah. Does it include everybody?
That's right. And if we were biased, we couldn't include everybody,
Have
would
us
we?
and them when you're
That's right.
biased.
We're biased about us and them. That's right. Yeah, that's basically
I
right.
find it interesting when I'm watching the grandson play soccer. When he's near the ball, I'm really excited. When anyone else is near the ball, it's like boring.
That's
And
it.
I always think at this point when I'm doing that, come on, we haven't fought these little kids
Yeah,
yet.
that's a great example.
It's true, I
That's
think I'm
terrific.
coming.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so you can see it manifest in the mind of bias. And
The bias really freaks me out because you can have, like with the soccer example, you can have a lot of care for your boy near the ball, and if somebody else gets the ball, now suddenly you don't like the somebody else,
Yeah, that's right.
and so then your care for someone turns into ill will
It
towards
can,
somebody
yeah,
else.
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is sort of common to a natural way.
Except I do remember a
That's
show
right.
about the Bhutanese,
Socrates.
the two teams at the very lowest of the soccer ladder, and I think it was Bhutan and Sierra Leone or something. And they played a game in Bhutan, and when one of the guys missed the goal, the compares are there, so and so is running, da, 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 and then oh, he misses the goal. Oh, I feel so much compassion.
Remember both sides, or especially the British, to keep reciting the Heart Sutra. Do you
Oh,
remember
right.
Yes, they had this equanimity, especially when the other side missed or something, they would have as much compassion for them as their own side. It was a very interesting match.
It's sort of like it's another whole perspective. Because sometimes when we're playing some card games, we'll be, are you gonna play hard or
That's
are you
right.
just gonna let someone win to be nice, it's a whole nother
Yeah, so
side.
you mentioned Tibetan elections, but the general people on TV were commenting about how extraordinary the light was. They were all praising the
Wow.
opposite stock.
Gee, guns are remarkable. So I have this illustration here to show how all of these can sort of function together. So you imagine a mother bird. Yeah? So love is her wish to feed her chicks. Compassion is her drive to protect them from a storm. Joy is her happiness when she sees them fly. And equanimity is the realization that every little bird or every little chick in the forest deserves the same care, not just their own. Now, something you might have noticed in the prayer books or when this equanimity prayer is recited, it's done in different ways. So what I mean by that is sometimes equanimity is at the very beginning and sometimes it's at the end. So I wanted to sort of address that and tell you why that might be. And so this is the one that's either at the beginning or the end in terms of these four measurements, the measurable equanimity. So here, this is the longer version where it says how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. May they abide in this way. I shall cause them to abide in this way. Please, Guru Buddha, inspire me to be able to do this. Now, this is an equanimity prayer specifically for the Mahayana. And it is this particular prayer, the equanimity coming at the beginning like this, is to form the basis for the development of the mind of enlightenment. It says here, in the context of the six preparatory practices and the Lam Rim tradition, equanimity is almost always practiced first. Why? Because before one can develop limitless love or compassion for all beings, one must remove the bias that favors friends and hates enemies. If the ground is not level, equanimity, the rain of love will pool only in the hollows of attachment and run off the steep hills of aversion. We must flatten the field before we can plant the crops. It says, without this initial leveling, our love is merely attachment and our compassion is biased. Therefore, we begin by sort of neutralizing the mind. But when equanimity is seen as the last step, this is seen to be like equanimity as a stabilizer. So in other contexts or specific meditative absorption trainings, equanimity is placed last. Why? Because equanimity functions as a sort of a governor to prevent the other emotions from becoming unbalanced. So it prevents love from turning into erotic attachment. It prevents compassion from turning into sentimental grief or depression. And it prevents joy from turning into manic excitement.
There's a question here from Esther. It might be a bit silly, but I'd really appreciate your advice. If there's certain bad apples in a box and you know how harmful they are, how do you practice good thinking and equanimity towards them? Is it okay to see them as they are and distinguish between good ones and bad ones? I struggle with equanimity.
Yeah. So what I find Esther using this idea of equanimity is to take the idea that if you're talking about like people, the bad apples are people, Esther. Right? So we go, okay. So what do we have in common with one another with these bad apples?
We're all apples.
We're all apples. That's right. That's right. That's the first one, right? We're all apples, right? And what makes us bad apples or good apples?
Diseases.
Yeah. Well, if you're looking at the humans, what makes what we call a bad human or a good human is
actions.
Yeah, behaviors.
Ignorance, basically.
Yeah, but ignorance has to manifest as something because we can't see ignorance. What do we see? We see behaviors. We see behaviors that are harmful, hurtful, or helpful. The ones that are harmful and hurtful, we call them, they're the bad apples, right? But again, what we do here is is it called conflating? When you push the two things together, we conflate the person with the behavior. And we call them bad apple, bad person. Right? But like I read a thing the other day in the Buddhist, I've never seen a bad person, ever. Because I've seen bad behaviors, but never bad people.
Yeah, that's the thing to remember over and over and over.
And it's a hard one to remember, isn't it? I find it quite difficult to remember. No, it's Trump's behavior, right? That is really disturbing and distressing. We should be looking at him as a bad apple, the bad guy. And yet this is a common thing that we all do, and it's encouraged by a number of different people too. Mr. Trump himself will do that.
But that's a great thing to remember. The Buddha said, I've never seen a bad person.
Yeah, that was the one that's
inspiring.
Me.
Yeah.
You know, wow, okay. No, but I've seen bad behaviours, and I know that the bad behaviours come out of bad mental states. And these can be altered. These can be changed so that what we once saw as a bad person can become a good person. I mean, this has happened again and again, hasn't it? So that's one thing. The other thing is that these apples all want to be happy. None of them wish to experience suffering, but they all experience suffering.
Because they'll all be a bad apple eventually.
Yeah, and it's just so like why? What's driving all this? And the major reason is because they don't know something. What we don't know, my simple way of looking at it, what we think is true is the world harming us. Other apples. Why do you take bad apples out of the apple barrel? Because, one bad one touches another one, they all start going bad. So And this is just cause and effect. So we, like I say, once you sort of, what's required of us is to instead of looking out there and thinking, these things are all harmful, it is the mind itself that is creating the harm. It looks at these objects, it conflates the behavior with the person, and now it really does look like someone out there is really hurting us and harming us. But hurt and harm is like, it's coming from our side, isn't it? Aren't we the ones feeling it? Yeah, there's no certainty at all, isn't it? I mean, I've had this experience myself. If you have like two people and one standing there together and one other person sees something unskillful, wicked, whatever, one person gets upset and the other doesn't. Why don't they both get upset? If this is the cause, surely they should both get upset?
Or in the soccer game, one kid scores a goal, yeah. One parent's happy and the other parent is...
That's right, or you get the whole side, isn't it? Every one whole side that supports is all unhappy, and the other side's happy. So, what is it? So there's a part that we're playing here, as I'm sort of saying, and we have to sort of... unravel it. Okay, so
it's a big issue.
Yeah, okay, so if you ask this, it's a good question to ask how best to do this. Because there's only two ways. That's the great thing for starters, right? Really, there's only two ways. And you can have a mixture of the two, of course. So one is change the world.
It's not that clear cut.
Why not?
Because, of course, Buddhist teachings.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Our own.
Yeah, of course. But like I said, this is the simple one of Shantideva said. Look, when the world is covered with thorns, you've got two options here. You can clear away all the thorns, or you can put leather on your shoes, on your feet.
That's about working with your own mind.
That's right.
But that's not about how you help others.
Of course it is.
That's not.
Excuse me. When you deal with your own mind, Sandy, where does the love come from? Where does the love come from?
The love.
Yeah, your love, your compassion for the other. Where's that coming from? It's coming from your mind, isn't it? It's not coming from the air, it's from us. But we develop it.
That's right.
Right. So if we are not peaceful people, how can we expect to have a peaceful world?
I think Sandy's question is, how do you be an activist as a Buddhist? And the answer would be, you have to have equanimity or exactly. You become an aggressor.
That's right. And you know...
Could you do it without equanimity?
This is actually a good class for us. So we develop a daily practice, right? So the practice on the cushion, this is where you develop your equanimity, all the reasons for being equanimous. Then you go out and practice it, like I say, on the ground. Then you see how well you go. So each supports the other.
Yeah.
It's not either or. Like I said, peace does not exist like external to us. Peace is created here, and from there we act peacefully, and that's what we call a peaceful world.
Yes.
It doesn't go the other way.
No.
No.
That's,
we could be in a peaceful environment with no conflict and be really cranky, like me. I've been living here for years. I'm still a cranky person.
In a peaceful way. It's not that they're not protesting, they are, but they're just doing it with
compassion,
kindness,
and this Holman hasn't lost his mind going like, or lost hope or got aggressive or any of those things over all those years.
We have to want to change this world. Because look at it, look how much suffering is in it. So where do we begin?
Mm.
We have to begin with ourselves. And so we have to become more peaceful. Then we can deal with these quite violent people. In fact, I remember doing You remember the, in the 60s when the race riots and so forth happening so often, and a lot of people were going down south into Alabama and that, facing up against the racist culture there. So they were trained, and like in India too, they were trained to actually take a blow, to be hit and to not respond violently themselves. Right? And so they did. They trained themselves beforehand, then they went in and copped that violence and did not respond violently back. That changed many of those people who hit them.
I've seen that.
Yeah, sure,
people do use their bodies to stand.
But the practice is rooted in the mind.
Exactly, and that's danger.
Angela says, I once heard His Holiness say, peace starts with inner disarmament.
Oh, great. Far out. Thank you, Angela. That's it. And that's what we're trying to do, is that's how you become the quantum. So you disarm aversion and attachment and, what would you say, disinclination, a sort of apathy. Well, let's do our first meditation, right? So we'll read for it out. So just get comfortable in your seat. It's a spine lengthen. And just allow your breath to settle into its natural rhythm. So our practice of altruism today is to arrange the internal conditions necessary for spiritual growth. So have you ever wondered why deep insights often feel out of reach despite our efforts? So deep insights or realizations depend on specific internal conditions. But in brief, it requires a purified and enriched mind. Without preparation, profound teachings cannot take root. So establishing a practice is like cultivating a garden. You can't throw the seeds on rocky ground and expect a harvest. So imagine it's your own room. It's your mind, so it's like a room. Is that room cluttered? So cleaning external space scrubs away the internal stains. So just as a gardener must pull weeds, purification clears the mind of negative emotions. So when you offer things to others, do you do it to impress them or to release the mind of scarcity? Or is it something else? So true offering generates energy to sustain practice. In the same way that a gardener adds fertilizer, accumulating merit gives the mind energy to flourish. Now, if you are stripped of your status, what solid ground would remain? We take refuge in wisdom as this ground, our true protection. But it's only when the soil is prepared can the seeds of Dharma ripen into realization. Engaging in the preparatory practices is preparing the soil. So if we try to generate limitless love right now, without first establishing equanimity, who would naturally be excluded from your wish? And how would that exclusion limit your own potential for awakening? So this week, try to tend to your mental soil before forcing a bloom. And let this preparation make your mind a suitable vessel for awakening. And just breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. So now we come in these terms of the preparations, what we call the field of merit. What I was sort of saying before, you know, it combats the sense of feeling alone, that we're just a solitary practitioner. We have no other support. So visualizing the merit field. And this is, it's easy to bring us closer to the desired end state. So our end state, what we desire is enlightenment for the benefit of all. That seems a little bit, might seem to be a little bit nebulous or sort of not so specific. So what, if I, in your own English words, what does it mean to become enlightened for the benefit of others? What do you think? What do you really have to do?
Be pure.
Yeah, and so pure in like what way? What are we trying to, what do we remove if you to be pure? Following the five precepts.
So that's removing bad behavior.
Okay, yeah.
Realization of emptiness and that they're all there.
Yep, so the realization.
Take refuge, rejoice, balance, hope, light.
So the way it's often explained is that we need to have wisdom and we need to have methods. So the wisdom is just saying the realization of emptiness. We need methods like equanimity, love and kindness, all these sort of things. And then what we need to do is to integrate them, which produces the skillful means. But so when Kinsa Rinpoche was teaching, Geshe Tashi Sero, he stopped us one time with talking about enlightenment. He goes, enlightenment, 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 what is that? And of course, it shocked all of us, and none of us had an answer. And he said, wisdom, compassion, skill. That's what you need. That's what we all need. Wisdom, compassion, skill. We have them all together, we're enlightened. So this field of merit is basically a visualization technique used in the preliminary stages to create a powerful object of focus. It serves as the recipient for our prayers, our offerings, and confessions. According to Lama Tsongkhapa, the purpose of this field is to allow the student to accumulate vast merit, which is described as positive psychological energy. So we certainly need this, especially like you're saying, so Sandy, if you're going along to, you know, it requires positive mental state. You want to go out there, you want to do good. Sometimes that's really hard, especially when you find other people behaving very badly to you trying to be good. As I say this, you have to be proficient, right?
Helping and protecting others.
I just remember in Minneapolis, a lot of the people there demonstrating, the witnesses there.
Yes.
We're saying love melts ice.
Yes.
And it was such a great, if they can be in that, if they can be in that, like it is a life and death situation.
Yes.
But they've got this mantra, love, that's what they lead with. And I'm so impressed with that.
Yeah.
Love melts ice.
Yeah. So that should be the driving thing, not many other motivations. Otherwise, other motivations are going to get you in trouble.
And plus, Sandy, you don't know who's a Buddhist or not in that crowd. Because you can't tell a Buddhist by looking at them.
I have a pretty good idea because I'm a Western.
Excuse me, we're talking about this program here, right? Not about rights and that sort of thing. It's a different class.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I know, it's okay, so it's a, you know, it's a big deal, it's an emotional thing, isn't it? Yeah. So when we do this visualization, right, of the merit field, this is not just imagination. The most important thing is, you know, sometimes it's hard to do this type of practice, to imagine all these enlightened beings and try to see them mentally. It's very hard. The idea is to feel as if they're there. It's more important to feel that you are in the presence of an enlightened field of energy. That's the most important thing, not that you see them clearly. But that can come later with more and more practice.
Just exposure.
Yeah, exposure to this feeling of acceptance, of wisdom, of skill. And that, you know, you are accepted within this. It's this idea, like I said before, a lot of people think that they're alone in their practices. This is the idea to say you are not alone. And what I take from this, I mean, remember this one that's saying, you know, the Buddha says, this is a couple of logic, and go, okay, are you known? And you have to go, are you known? And you can go, of course I'm known. You know me, I know you. I am an object of knowledge. So, what's one of the great skills of the Buddha? They know all objects of knowledge. If it exists, they know it. It's an omniscient mind. Now, wherever the mind of the Buddha is, the body of the Buddha is. So if he knows me, then he's right there. There's no difference between mind and body here. So never despair.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I remember one time I was talking to Venerable Ravina, we were looking at the tankas, and I was saying, oh, yeah, it's like the Buddhas are there looking in at us through the windows. And she's like, no, Miffy, the Buddhas are always here. It's us looking out the window to the Buddhas.
Okay, so we've got this. So we imagine, okay, and feel as if they're all present. And now we're going to behave in a particular way towards them. You know, we say, reverently, I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. You know? So we develop a sense of humility in this field of enlightenment. So the purpose, each limb has a purpose. But let's look at what these limbs are, first of all. So you can see I've written them up here. There is prostration, that's the first one. Reverently, I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I make offerings, that's the second one. I confess all my negativities, the third one. I rejoice in all the goodness of all sentient beings and enlightened beings. I make these requests, please, that I stay here, teach me. We'll never let this path go. They're not a ritual, they're basically a psychological technology designed to prepare the mind for realization. So when I was preparing this class and thinking about it, I had like different analogies that sprung to mind. And so one of them, a simple one, was like, you know, when you go to the beach, what do you do?
Have a swim.
Yeah, when you're there, what do you do before you got there?
Anticipate.
Yeah, okay, and? Did anybody put their togs on? Did anyone get ready to swim? Surely.
Sunscreen.
Togs. Towel. You prepare before you actually swim.
Yeah, that's what I used to say. Prepare.
Good idea, you got it. That's what this is about. It's preparing the mind to develop all these qualities. And what they're saying is that if you don't do this, it's not going to happen. This what comes to me. In fact, like a Dhamma lineage, this is their major practice, the seven limbs. They prepared the mind to practice, then they practice. So if you're practicing and it's going nowhere, maybe it's because you haven't prepared the mind for it.
Just as an aside, like in there is rejoice, right? So
yes.
So Sandy, maybe when you go to a demo, rejoice at everybody who's there. And rather than despair at everybody who's not there, it'll give you energy.
I'm experiencing both, Nikki. Like,
but Sandy, wait,
Sandy, you're not hearing this.
As a practice, from our side, and I found this with rejoicing, that especially when you're feeling low or tired, it's actually something that gives you energy when you don't have energy. So it's an amazing preparation. It's like the trick of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and you just think it's not possible. And then instead of just trying to push harder, which is normally what I do, the rejoicing is like all the energy flows in. And here it's the energy of the Buddhas that flows in. It's not even
sentient beings,
but it's also Buddhas.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the idea to have to feel their presence. And then to, like say, to rejoice.
Which is an uplifting thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So again, so, in your thing, Sandy, when you look to who's not there, check what your mind does. Because if it goes down, this is not the thing, this, you're doing it, this is not good.
So there's something wrong with me.
No.
Being disappointed that there aren't more
Buddhists there.
Yeah,
that's right, okay.
I'm disappointed. Yeah. I don't understand. Yeah.
Well, instead of having more compassion for them then. So this idea of the seven rooms is to prepare the mind for the realization. So it's like to prepare the body to go swimming. We've got to get ready to then we engage. So what is this merit that we've been talking about? There are many different explanations of it, and the meaning differs depends upon the context. But merit is basically like spiritual fuel, mental fuel. It gives you the keep going. And this, I'm just talk for a moment, folks. Yeah, I'm going to move on. So just to keep us going. And as you know, this is the seven-limb prayer, right? So I've highlighted each little colour here to show you that when we say reverently, I prostrate, what does that mean? That it means I come to this with a sense of humility. So with my body, speech and mind, I am humble within the sphere of enlightenment in the face of all these beings. So then we make the offerings to say, it's not poor pity me, I've got nothing to give. You have plenty to give. You're lacking nothing. You have everything that we require to become enlightened, which is basically a mind that has no inherent existence. So everything is basically good from here. But we've all got these disturbing emotions. So we have to confess. We've got to drop that burden, get rid of it, open ourselves up. And then we rejoice all those who have done that and all those who are trying to do that and all the ordinary sentient beings who've done any little skerrick of goodness. We're glad. Thank goodness there's goodness in the world. People are, even though we know there's also badness, but we're not focused on that. That's not the focus. We're focusing on the good. And we rejoice in that. We want these people who have taught us these methods to stay. We want the teachings to remain. So whatever I do, I want to let merit I create go towards that goodness. May it bring about the changes we want in the world. Now, so here what I've done, I've got this. So these first three, prostration, offering, and confession, is what we're just covering today. I've blocked out the bottom in blue, but we're going to cover that next week. So here we can see what we're doing. So you can see the prostration, we're accumulating the merit of devotion and this humility, and we devote. The function is to produce a physical and mental respect, and you can see what the antidote is towards afflictive pride or arrogance.
So it makes you open, doesn't it?
Yeah, open, and also like you said, for this, to get rid of the scarcity mindset. This thing we often we want. We don't have enough. We've got to have more. Here it's saying, look, we've got plenty.
Well, that's offering.
Yeah, this is the offering part, right? So what can you offer? You said, my body speaks in mind. I can offer that. In fact, that's what we are actually offering to the Chi Tsings, aren't we? But that requires a sense of humility. So that's why we have the humility first. Then now this is what we've got to offer. And then it's like, I've got these problems. As much as I want to offer my body, speech, and mind to the welfare of all beings, oftentimes I try and do that, I get in my own way. Like, I get upset, cranky, short-tempered, I lose my patience, all these sort of things. Right? This is not contributing towards this goal. So I need to, it's called laying down a burden. So the burden is all these mental states that we've got that produce suffering for ourselves and others. That's our burden. And the great thing is we can lay it down because they don't truly exist. But I think in many ways this idea of laying down just means stop clinging to it as if it was real. Stop thinking it's so real.
I love it just because then you have the lightness and the freedom when you lay it down.
Yeah.
And we don't have to have all those negativities as our possessions, like hoarders.
Many years ago, there was a film made with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons. There were two missionaries that went into the jungle in the Amazon. Has anybody seen that film? Right? You're laughing. You would have seen it. It's not the science books. Anyway, so what happened in the film? Robert De Niro is a soldier fella. He's out there making a solution. He finds out that his brother's been having an affair with his wife. He kills his brother. He's so distraught after doing it. He wants to be a penitent. He's got to pay for this. So what he does, he goes, well, the problem is, like, I'm a soldier. So he strips off all his armor, wraps up in a big bundle, and he ties it around himself. And wherever he walks, he carries that load. Yeah. He meets this priest. He says, we're going into the Amazon jungle to meet these natives. So in this film, you see him, like, he's always the last guy, and he's going clunk, 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 right? All his armor going over the roots. So you don't have to climb this massive waterfall, right? Of course, he's master. And so he's climbing up, everybody else is up there, they're walking along and there's this Indian guy watching him. So De Niro finally gets up there, it's crawling up the rooftop, pulls the last bit of the armor up, and then this Indian guy steps out of the machine and just goes whack, cuts the rope and the armor falls back, right down off the falls. And De Niro's face is enraged, right? And then next thing it's like, I come free. There's no weight on me. And he bursts out into this huge smile and laugh. I said, that's like us. We carry all this crap around. There's no need for it.
You've got to do purification to
let go. And death is, wow, because I'm a bad guy. I did this terrible thing to my brother. I should suffer. But this is being a penitent. But when the guy freed him, I just remember how his face changed. And then his whole way of behavior changed. And this is the same thing for us. We have got to cut our grasping, our holding on to, in particular, ideas, wrong ideas, and be free of them. So we just quickly. So in our frustrations, basically, this is what we're doing each time. We're trying to restrain, reduce, and then abandon what afflictive pride or another word that's called arrogance. So we put afflictive pride in there because there are types of pride that are good, useful, and we should develop them. There's others that are not. And then there's, what do we do? Replace that with respect, humility, and appreciation. That's this idea of the prostration as well as doing. Now, basically, it's an antidote to afflicted pride and arrogance. So when I first came to the centre, for years and years, I'd never prostrate. Until I discovered what the purpose was. But when I discovered that, I thought, there you go, like the arrogance that I had, I'm not doing that. They go, why? Because I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know its purpose. And Rudisha says, ah, so you're taking refuge in ignorance. Oh my God, that rocked me through the yoga. Right? That's a refuge, isn't it? Ignorance. And then I found out what its point was. I go, oh my God, I've got to do prostrations. I'm one of those arrogant guys. It's quite great when you discover this. Next one is the offerings. So here we're to try to restrain, reduce, and abandon our stinginess, and basically sort of create a mindset of abundance and generosity. So we reverse the psychology of scarcity. Then we come to purification. So purification is an antidote to the three poisons, and you lay down your burden using the four powers. These four powers, I'll show you the process of it here. So we create an action, and this, the action has a basis, an attitude. You perform the action, and then the action is finished. That imprints the mind, so it puts what we call a potential on the mind or a seed on the mind. Now, if it's negative, that's what we're carrying. That's what we've got to lay down. We've got to get rid of. And the way we do that is using these four opposing powers. So with remorse, this stops having experiences like what we've just done. What drove us to do that action? Having remorse stops that. Stops the experiences like that, the cause. Then the remedy stops the throwing karma. The resolve means we don't keep behaving in the same way we used to. And lastly, reliance prevents fruition in lower realm rebirth and having an experience in the environment of that.
What do you mean by reliance?
So when we take reliance, reliance is refuge in the mind of enlightenment. So and if you really look at what refuge is, it's behaving in accordance with the Buddha's teaching of cause and effect. So if we know that if I do this, this is what follows, so I'm not going to do this, then that can't follow. And so these effects come. Now, in terms of the antidotes or the remedies to stop that throwing karma, there are many things we can do. There are six that are often mentioned. One is to read the sutras. The other is to recite the names of enlightened beings or reciting mantra. You can create different images of the enlightened beings, offer worship, and finally have an interest in emptiness, because emptiness is the soul of it all.
So we've been having our sutra challenge to read as many times of the Dhammakaya Sutras possible in these holy days. So today is the day that we'll offer tonight when we do our sutra recitation.
Yeah, so these are ways of purifying, but you also know the other ways too, of course, and these are the Vajrasattva and 35 Compassion Buddhas. These also are useful means. One is sutra and one is tantra. The Vajrasattva is primarily tantra, Compassion Buddhas is sutra. But again, we rely upon something to help us. You know, the refuge in bodhicitta. The regrets is a prayer. It's all summarized. And you know, what do we do in this type of thing? Well, in this method here, we're doing prostrations and reciting the names. That's the major one. But in this other one, we're doing the mantra and visualizing the nectar going down. So two different methodologies there, along with those other six.
Esther asks, what about pilgrimage? Is that type of purification?
It can certainly be a process one, Esther. It can be a purification and an accumulation of merit. If you actually look at these things, it's really hard sometimes to discern where the dividing line is. Yeah, often they're sort of both. Yes, so in fact, many people in the past have gone on pilgrimages, haven't they, to purify the mind, of course, to accumulate the merit, the positive energy.
Yeah, because when it's difficult on a pilgrimage, that's seen as the purification part, and then you make all the offerings when you get there, and that's the...
Okay, accumulation part.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've had plenty of interesting chat already, so and it's nearly over. So we'll put that aside and listen to the meditation. Okay, our last meditation. Okay, once again, just adjust your posture. Just sort of lengthen your spine so it feels like an arrow of light. And just let your breath settle into a natural, unforced rhythm. And so we're going to, our purpose for doing this meditation is to clear away our mental debris so that we might better serve ourselves and others. So imagine entering a really dark room within yourself that's long been neglected. It's filled with broken furniture, dust, and the weeds of past actions. But visualizing the merit field is like switching on a massive, high-intensity floodlight into this dark, cluttered basement of mind. Because, you know, we cannot clean what we cannot see. By visualizing the holy beings, the floodlight, contrast is heightened. The brilliant light of their purity immediately reveals the dirt of our own negativities, making the act of sweeping them away not only possible, but urgent. But why visualize external beings if the work is internal? The beings of the merit field act like a mirror. Seeing their perfection highlights our own clutter, showing us exactly what we need to clean. Well, how has the physical act of bowing or prostrating changed the mind? Physically lowers the ego, crumbling the mountain of pride that often blocks the light of wisdom. But why offer imaginary gifts? To release the tight fist of miserliness. The act of giving loosens attachment and opens the heart to abundance. Can we truly erase the history of our negative actions? The answers are yes, and we do it through the power of regret. So just as fire burns seeds, genuine remorse destroys the potential for a negative result to ripen. How do we ensure that our mind stays clean? This is through a resolve. We decide not to repeat a mistake. This closes the door to our room becoming dirty. We seal our practice with this promise. So in your own time, try to imagine just clearing away one specific stone of negativity from your mental garden. And just carry this sort of inner lightness with you. A mind that is prepared is the foundation of your happiness. And now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. Keep your eyes wide open. Move your body. Feel comfortable. We know we've come to the end of our session today. So what's the takeaway? Well, you should know what the causes of refuge are. Can somebody tell me?
Fear.
Fear, good. And faith. Excellent, thank you. And these purposes of prostration. So why do we prostrate? To develop humility, to overcome. Yeah, ego, pride, that's a fifth of pride, that sort of thing. Charity, why do we practice charity? It's sort of this mind of abundance, isn't it? And to work against this sort of stinginess, isn't it? Purification, like sort of covers like everything that we've done with our body, speech, and mind. We want to clear the place up, lay down the burden, make it easier for us to actually engage in practice that's useful and realize it. Okay, so if you have this text with you, please keep reading this method to transform a suffering life into happiness. You'll see it in the speech lesson, and you can practice that again. And so next week, of course, we've got to go through the other four limbs of this seven limb practice, which we'll do. This brings us to our dedication. So let's please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase evermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The prayer for His Holiness' long life. The wish granted, the wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all the holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the prayer for the quick discovery and swift return of Rinpoche. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.